Hello again and welcome to another edition of Authors Audio. I'm your host, Jake D. Steele. Dr. Jerome Corsi is a staff reporter for WorldNet Daily. He received his PhD from Harvard University in Political Science in 1972. He has written many books and articles, including The Late Great USA, Black Gold Stranglehold, The Myth of Scarcity, and The Politics of Oil, and also Atomic Iran. It's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Jerome Corsi back to the program. Hello, Jerome. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Jake. It's great to be back with you. Thank you very much.
Welcome back to the program, Jerome. We are going to talk about your book, Atomic Iran, but just for a moment, I'd like to ask you how your book, The Late Great USA, is doing and what things have gone on in the last 6 months or so since we chatted. Are we any closer to a North American union with the Amerodollar now?
Well, I think many of the things I predicted and wrote about in The Late Great USA are happening. I mean, we are now, I predicted that we would be going through an economic downturn and the dollar would have to take a nosedive in order to create the conditions to have an Amero, a new currency for North America replacing the dollar. And I think that's well along the way. The dollar is now hitting historically low points against the euro. It's dropping on the dollar indexes across, you know, the major currency markets. And we're having economists, I think, overwhelmingly now acknowledge that we are, if not just into a slowdown, into a recession. I think the recession's been going on for over a year. And with the economic crisis and the mortgages we're having, you know, throughout the country, there's millions of people that have lost their homes or are at risk of losing their homes as home prices go down in major markets. So people who are in troubled mortgages where their payments are going up can't sell the homes and get enough money to bail out and pay completely the mortgages they're in. They have to take a loss to sell the homes. So this is a kind of a crisis. And as you look at the presidential election, state after state, now we're looking at this Super Tuesday, and I've been writing how the 24 states involved in Super Tuesday contests have lost 1.5 million manufacturing jobs since George Bush took office. This is the crisis that the economic results, I think, that are inevitable as we move toward a North American Union, because the American people would never abandon the U.S. market or American sovereignty or embrace a new currency like the Amero unless we were so deep into a financial crisis that when, you know, the financial leaders come forward and say, well, we have to form a North American common market and a North American union to compete with Europe, and we'll need a new currency. And I think as this crisis deepens, the stage is set for that argument. So economically, I think the predictions I made that we would continue the outsourcing, we would continue losing jobs, the middle class would continue to suffer, and that we would have a major economic downturn in which the dollar would be under severe distress, that's now all well in the works. And I think those, you know, those are no longer predictions. I think they're here and upon us.
Well, I see where the monetary scientists at the Federal Reserve had decided to print up a little bit more money or borrow more money, billions of dollars again, to give the average American maybe $600 to $1,200 extra for a spending bonus this year to get the economy going. However, how do you see that? That obviously is not going to be the real answer to any kind of recovery, is it?
Well, they're thinking to get a fiscal stimulus, you know, put some more money in people's hands. And it's not a bad idea to put money in people's hands. I think that's a good idea. But one time getting a tax rebate check is not going to solve the problem. I mean, they're not going to send the jobs back with that tax rebate check. The jobs are still gone. And when you look at states like Michigan or Ohio, these states are now like Appalachia. The middle class job base of manufacturing is gone. It's not coming back. And these states going into a service economy don't have any way of recovering. There's nothing in the service economy to export. And this is part of, I think, the economic difficulty of going into a global market, is that the middle class in the United States is going to get severely pounded. It's part of the process. Now, it's going to cause a severe worldwide depression, because we've had just come through the worst Christmas season maybe in 40 years, and the American consumer has been the backbone of the world economy. But as Americans lose their homes, lose their jobs, have to go into service jobs that don't pay nearly as much, they can find those at all, clearly there's going to be less consumer spending, and that's going to drive markets worldwide down, which is what's happening. And again, I think that's part of the plan. As world markets collapse, the solution will be more globalism, which will mean eventually that the companies and the multinational corporations are planning, maybe they won't have such a strong U.S. market to sell into, but they had to break the back of the American middle class in order to break the back of the United States as a nation state. And then the world market, maybe not as affluent as the American middle class ever was, but much larger, will be intended to replace what the American consumer is no longer able to consume. This is a change that's happening, and it's happening quite fast. And I think you can see at the same time the politics are moving forward. I mean, we still have, you know, there's now President Bush announced in the State of the Union that there'll be another North American summit in New Orleans in April. I noticed he changed the name. He didn't explicitly say, like they did for Montebello in Quebec in August, that this was the fourth summit coming up in New Orleans of the Security and Prosperity Partnership in North America. George Bush sidestepped those issues and renamed the conference. But it's still going forward. And now we've had the open declaration that this Transatlantic Economic Council was created in April. The first meeting of it was held on November 9th in Washington, D.C., and the Transatlantic Economic Council is on a mission to create a transatlantic union by 2015. And in that transatlantic union, one partner will be the European Union in the common market, and the other partner will be the U.S., but really it'll be another move to say the U.S. partner is a North American partner. And if we get the North American Union together by that time, it'll be European Union, North American Union, united in a transatlantic union. And these unions will be economic compacts that will necessitate more international rules, administrative law, ultimately judicial processes. So, you know, just like the European Union, the same model, first get the economic agreements together, and then the political agreements will follow, is now being used on a global basis.
Yes, well, Jerry, your point is well taken. I know in England, for example, that people are very fed up with the bureaucracy that the EU has drummed up for them. Their own parliamentary members can't really do anything in their parliament for their constituencies. They're basically running back and forth from the EU with tons and tons of bureaucratic nonsense to sign and then take back to Brussels. It's just ridiculous what's going on.
Well, it's the same across. I mean, look at what they're doing. The Constitution for the European Union Constitution was rejected. France and I believe Belgium rejected it. And so now what they're doing is they created a treaty that does not have to be put to a vote, and they're getting it signed by the countries. So again, the bureaucrats don't have public accountability. They backdoor through agreements that don't have to go through duly constituted legislatures, and they just get agreements and they put their rules in effect anyway. And the people in Europe have totally lost control of their self-governance. And now it's a bureaucratic arbitrary system where the bureaucrats make the decisions, and these decisions are like decisions which will be coming here. I mean, if you want to buy vitamins in Europe, it's almost criminal anymore. You can't get vitamin E or vitamin C unless you've got a prescription, and then it's very expensive. The reason is because the agenda is driven by the multinational corporations and the multinational pharmaceutical companies and agribusinesses don't want the vitamin supplement companies competing with them. So in Europe, the European Union looks not to the countries to know what the rules should be on food supplements and food, but they look to the World Trade Organization or the UN's Codex Alimentarius, which is all rigged in favor of the major pharmaceutical companies and the big food companies, and that's what the regulations look like in the EU. Now, we're doing the same thing here in the United States. We've got the food and, you know, agriculture working group of our bureaucrats, Mexico's and Canada's. We've got the multinational advisory group, the North American Competitiveness Council, which is 30 top corporations handpicked by the Chambers of Commerce in each country. And they're the only ones who meet in Montebello or will meet in New Orleans behind closed doors. There won't be any, you know, C-SPAN. There won't be any union advocates or consumer advocates in that meeting. And these 30 companies on the North American Competitiveness Council will tell the North American Food and Agricultural Working Group that they want to have the same kind of, you know, vitamin supplement regulations put into place that get put into place in Europe, which again is a repeat of the UN's Codex Alimentarius. And then the FDA will follow suit and say, okay, well, now we'll take our marching orders, not from laws passed in the U.S. Congress on agriculture or vitamin supplements, but from the working group in North America, which has now signed an agreement with Canada and Mexico to implement these new standards. But just take a look at the SPP.gov working, you know, website right now, sanpeterpaul.gov. That website reports the agreement made in Montebello, Quebec, on avian flu and pandemic influenza. The working groups agreed and signed that, it, you know, should there be avian flu or a influenza pandemic in North America, the United Nations is in charge. It's not the U.S. Congress. It's not our rules. This wasn't submitted to the Congress for approval, but you can see the working group agreement that was declared. I don't think you can read the exact working group agreement, but you can see the declaration of it in the center of the SPP.gov website under the Montebello announcements. So the blue helmets are in charge. And if it comes to quarantining people or giving vaccinations or withholding vaccinations or whatever the international health authorities decide to do in a North American avian flu or influenza pandemic incident, Congress will just have to stand by and do what it's told. And so will the American people.
Well, Jerry, you know, it's become very self-evident, I think, to most people that the Congress and even the executive branch is just gone to work for the international corporate interest. I mean, the average American citizen might as well hang up their hat. They probably can't even get a phone call to Congress. They just simply aren't listening. They aren't protecting the borders. They aren't taking care of the economy. They aren't making sure the jobs are kept in the country. It's obviously self-evident to me that they're just letting all this go so that they can rationalize the new idea of a North American union. And I can see it as clear as day.
Well, and, you know, look at the... I'll give you another example of how this is proceeding. I mean, the Mexican truck demonstration project that was implemented by, you know, the Department of Transportation is still ongoing. Okay, now, we've had a situation where Congress voted, Senator Dorgan, Democrat of North Dakota, voted, put an amendment forward to take the money away from the Department of Transportation. So the Department of Transportation doesn't have the funds to continue this Mexican truck demonstration project. That was included in the omnibus funding bill, which passed and President Bush signed it. Now, the Department of Transportation has just told Congress that they are not going to obey the law. They say that they started the demonstration project in September, and the law didn't get considered until after that, so it doesn't apply to them. Now, the Legislative Council for Congress wrote an interpretation, said this is what the legislative history shows, and it shows that the Dorgan Amendment was intended to block this precise Mexican trucking experiment that started in September. And Department of Transportation, the Bush administration, says, we don't care. we're going to continue anyway, even if it means breaking the law. And to Congress, they'll say, what are you going to do about it? And that's the stalemate we're in right now. So Congress passed the law, they took the money away, and the Department of Transportation decided just to ignore it. And there, too, people think, well, you know, we're enforcing here a NAFTA treaty obligation. That's what Senator John Cornyn argued in the floor of the Senate. But NAFTA is not a treaty. And even more, Bill Clinton, when president, decided that Mexican trucks did not meet U.S. standards, and he wasn't going to allow them to come in under NAFTA. So what we're enforcing here is a NAFTA tribunal decision, NAFTA Chapter 11 tribunal, which reversed Bill Clinton's decision and demanded under NAFTA that we let the trucks come in. And now the Department of Transportation has said they're going to do what the NAFTA tribunal wants, to the complete ignoring of a congressional law which took their money away, so the Mexican trucks are still going to continue to roll. I mean, that's a complete disregard of Congress and the president in terms of going for a NAFTA tribunal, which is above our law now, and saying to Congress, we don't care that you passed a law, we're not going to obey it.
Well, Jerry, I'd also like to bring up your book that you wrote in 2005, Atomic Iran, in which a lot of the things that you mentioned in that book are now coming into fruition in 2008 and beyond. Iran also has some of the world's largest deposits of gas and oil, and yet they continue to develop a underground plan to develop nuclear potential, not only just for energy, but it looks very strongly for weapons-grade plutonium to be used in nuclear weapons. So I'd like you to comment on that, if you would.
Well, it's another book, Atomic Iran, that I think I published it in 2005. I was writing it at the end of 2004. And I think, again, everything I wrote in the book is happening. I mean, Russia has now done 6 deliveries of uranium to Iran so that they can start this power plant, this nuclear power plant at Bashar. I think it'll be up and running and fully active by this time next year. And that's, again, received very little press. It's been kind of undercover. And that's while Iran's continuing to enrich its own uranium at Natanz. It's now got, you know, it's hard to say how many centrifuges they've got running now. They probably have more than 5,000 centrifuges running. And Natanz is active, and they're constantly improving their ability to enrich uranium. Eventually, they'll have it mastered. I don't know exactly how long it'll take them, but it won't take more than a year or two to get that process down to where they can run the centrifuges. They'll have 25,000 centrifuges going, and they'll be able to enrich uranium to weapons grade if they want to on their own. They didn't stop their own enrichment of uranium, even after the United Nations Security Council voted sanctions, and Russia didn't withhold delivering uranium for Bashar, the peaceful nuclear power plant, even though, the Iranians didn't stop enriching their own uranium and are in defiance of the UN. And the Iranians are proceeding on this as to say, well, who's going to stop us? Well, and they also take the money with oil at $90 a barrel or higher that they're getting from oil, and they're putting it into not the people. The people in Iran continue to suffer. They're suffering economic poverty. They're struggling. They have high inflation. What Iran is doing, the mullahs and the Ahmadinejad regime, is they're continuing to fund Hezbollah in Lebanon. They're funding Hamas in Gaza, and now, you know, basically funding terrorism in both of these instances as they put a tighter vise around Israel. And Israel is beset by Lebanon. Lebanon is, Hezbollah now in Lebanon has completely, I believe, rearmed in terms of the missiles after this most recent war where Israel tried to get the missiles and Hezbollah out of southern Iran, southern Lebanon. They couldn't do it. And now with the Gaza almost out of control, completely under the thumb of the Hamas, and the Bush administration is pushing Israel to take a look at the West Bank and to try to create a two-state solution with Hamas controlling the Palestinian Authority, whereas Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran are all sworn to the destruction of Israel.
Well, Jerry, the Middle East seems to be living up to its name and actions, as the Annapolis summit was just over and everybody's talking about peace and how they can find a road to peace, roadmap to peace. And as soon as they get back home, of course, everything gets right back where it used to be, and the Israelis are lobbing weapons into the Palestinian territories. The Palestinians, of course, are trying at every chance to kill Israelis. There doesn't seem to be any answer that I can see in the future for Israel and Palestine to be peaceful unless there's a major change over there.
Well, and what you've got a situation where, you know, the Bush administration coming out of Annapolis and then Condi Rice going back to the Middle East, George Bush going back to the Middle East. I mean, you know, George Bush can shed a tear in the Holocaust Museum, but he's still pressuring Israel to work with Hamas and to even divide Jerusalem in order to create a Palestinian state. Now, as Israel continues to give up more territory and not get any real peace, and if you take a look at the Hamas and the Gaza Strip, you know, Hamas is not economically developing the Gaza Strip. They're just taking money and paying the people. There's, again, poverty in the Gaza Strip. Palestinian people are being intentionally kept, discontent, unemployed, and poor, with the level of dissatisfaction being focused against Israel. And there's no solution here that will forecast the long continuance of the Israeli state, because you've got these forces pointed against Israel. They're all hostile and gaining strength through the Iranian funding. And Iran right now may be backed off funding the terrorists within Iraq while we have the surge going, but I have no confidence that once the surge lets up, Iran won't return to working with the Shiite radicals, with al-Qaeda elements that remain or can be re-injected into Iraq and start again causing trouble there. Unless you have, you know, the kind of military presence that Saddam Hussein himself had, which was a, you know, brutal dictatorship, over a military dictatorship over the Iraqi people, I don't think you're going to have any fundamental peace in Iraq without that military presence. And Iran is just poised, waiting for the opportunity to go back in and cause trouble.
Well, and to add insult to injury, we also have, after Bhutto's death in Pakistan is much more on the edge. We haven't seen any elections in Pakistan yet. The Taliban are supposed to be alive and well in Pakistan. And do you think Iran has any of its agents working in there to stir things up as well?
No question about it. Iran is part of the, I'm sure the Revolutionary Guard has a presence in that wild mountainous region to the west of Pakistan. And I think it's increasingly clear, you know, I published analyses of the videos of Bhutto's assassination on WorldNet Daily, and I think it was very clear that this was most likely a government setup job, because the government changed the story three or four times, you know, of how she was killed. It was very clear that a young, well-dressed gunman, military, with a handgun that was a military handgun, came up behind her and that leaving that rally and fired three shots at her, and she fell back into the car. You can see it from the three shots. It wasn't from the explosion that forced her again, you know, her head to hit the latch of the sunroof. That was one of the stories. It wasn't shrapnel from the explosion. She was already back down in the car, having been shot at least once in the head from that gunman, and Musharraf has obfuscated that. It's not been investigated effectively. Nobody's been arrested. And, you know, and again, this is a failure of Condi Rice. Condi Rice was in trying to say, we'll bring Bhutto back and we'll get Musharraf to share the presidency. Musharraf's a military dictator. Military dictators don't share power easily. And Condi Rice, to think that was just going to happen, was being naive, as she's been about much of her policy throughout the Middle East, but her naivete ends up supporting the Islamic forces who are adverse to Israel. We have absolutely no control now at all over Pakistan's western region. You know, for all I know, Osama bin Laden is there. The Taliban is there, chased out of Afghanistan. And I'm sure Al-Qaeda's in there, whether, you know, Osama bin Laden's there or not. It's a refuge area, tribal zone, that Pakistan can't even safely send its own security forces into.
Well, it's a real hornet's nest. I mean, you have that country over there, as you know, which is very, very mountainous and hard to get around, even at the best of times of year, in Pakistan and, of course, Afghanistan also. So these areas are very hard to fight in or gain control of. It takes a long period of time. The Soviets were in there for, 10 years in Afghanistan?
Right. These peoples in the Middle East that we're trying to deal with, and President Bush keeps talking about democracy. I'd like to remind the administration that we're not a democracy. We're a constitutional republic. And the idea that you're going to go into these regions and create democracies from basically tribal people who have been fighting for centuries, Shiites against Sunnis, and have them all forget about this, plus the ethnic differences and the national differences which separate these people, I mean, and then tribal areas where, you know, the people in those northwestern region, mountainous regions of Pakistan, I doubt if they consider themselves Pakistani. Remember, the Pakistanis were from India. They were from when the Muslims were thrown out of India in Gandhi's time. You know, Bangladesh is the other part of what was Pakistan, east and west, going back to the, you know, the early phases of the British leaving India when Gandhi was alive. This goes back to the late 1940s. And, you know, the Pakistanis are Indian Hindus. I mean, Indian Muslims. The Indian Hindus were the ones who remained in India, expelling the Indian Muslims.
And, of course, as most people do know now, Pakistan does have deliverable nuclear weapons, as does India. And Iran in that neighborhood is saying to the rest of the world, well, even if we were developing those weapons, we have to. Look who else has them.
Well, and with, you know, with Musharraf in power, I mean, again, you've got a military dictator, but if what Condi Rice was doing, introducing Bhutto, destabilized Musharraf's control, you could easily have those nuclear weapons pass into the hands of whatever radical faction managed to take over the Pakistani government in chaos. And it's still possible that Pakistan could devolve down into street chaos. There's not been a new election. I don't know when there's going to be a new election. If there is a new election, I don't know that it won't be rigged. I mean, these are the kinds of problems you face in this region. I'm not even sure we have the, you know, Iraqi parliament or government truly working in our interests. The Iraqi government works constantly with Iran. Ahmadinejad, I believe, here is scheduled to make another visit or a visit over to Iraq very closely to this time. And you've had the top leaders of the Iraqi government over in Tehran. I mean, the Shiites in the two countries relate to each other as Shiites, even if their nationalities and languages are different. You know, the Iranians are Persian who speak Farsi, and the Shiite Iraqis are basically Arabic in descent, who speak, you know, Arabic dialects. They're not Persians, and they don't speak Farsi, even if they're Shiites. And you've got the rise of Persian now in the Middle East, which is, you know, frightening the Sunni states. It's frightening the Sunni minority in Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and we just did another big military contract to Saudi Arabia, you know, in concern about the rise of Iran. But the Shiites right now are the most they're driving the politics. The radical Shiites from Iran are driving the politics of the Middle East now, the way that Nasser and the Sunnis drove the politics in a radical direction in the 50s. And you got the same element. Russia is today involved supporting Iran the same way Russia in the 50s supported Egypt. and they're not doing it for our benefit.
No, they're definitely not. Russia is getting further away from the West in terms of ideologies. I can see that. And they're much more confident. Of course, they've got a good economy, and they love to sell weapons, and they certainly do. What about the... I think we mentioned at one time, or someone mentioned it, about the idea of the CIA getting some operatives into Iran to encourage the people to move out of the current political system there. Have you heard anything that brings light to that might could happen?
Well, I continue to be, and I've since I wrote the books Atomic Iran, going back into 2004 and 2005, I've been arguing that the only solution here is to support the Iranian expatriates around the world who want to bring freedom to their country and to support the Iranian freedom fighters within Iran. Because a war is going to be the worst possible thing we could do. War will just unite the Iranian people against the United States. It's going to be a very difficult war. You know, this is not a video game. There's probably 1,000 sites that would be one way or the other related to the nuclear program in Iran. There's clearly going to be 25 that are very important in the program. And taking them out is going to, with, you know, airstrikes or cruise missiles, is difficult. The Russians have supported, you know, getting a couple generations now of surface-to-air missile systems. They sold a $1 billion Tor M1 system to Iran. They continue to provide Iran with, you know, defense systems against air attack. If we send an air attack in, or Israel did, we're going to lose planes. And we've got conventional troops in the region. Israel is right there. Even a conventional missile retaliation by Iran would kill thousands of U.S. troops, and it would kill thousands of Israelis. And it would be a total disaster.
What gets me and what I'm thinking of is if a person like yourself, if we could create a scenario of Pakistan becoming more and more problematic and less governed, that decay there, I think, is going to make it much easier for Iran to totally move ahead in ways that it wants to move ahead, right?
Oh, I agree. I mean, Iran is positioned to use any lack of stability in the region to its own advantage. You know, Iran could cause trouble in Lebanon in a minute's notice, you know, just another assassination or another parliamentary disturbance. And Hezbollah now has quite a good presence within the parliament in Lebanon. Hamas within the Gaza could, you know, become radical and increase and try to increase suicide attacks or other acts of violence against Israel anytime. You know, the Israelis are constantly going into the Gaza with airstrikes trying to kill radical Hamas leaders who are planning terrorist attacks on Israel. Israel just recently attacked some site in Syria, probably a nuclear establishment. It's never been fully explained, just a few months ago. So, you know, this region, the Middle East, is one suicide attack, one bomb, one misstep away from a regional war at any day.
Well, I have to agree, Jerry. There's decay and trouble all around that region, and that it wouldn't take much to light the fire over there, that's for sure.
You know, the Israelis are probably the best indication of it because I think they've got the best intelligence. And they're acting like something's got to be done in 2008. Now, the Israelis also have their own internal problems. This Olmert government has not been a strong government. They've wanted to have peace with the radical Muslim forces, including Iran. They've wanted the world to come to their help and to apply sanctions against Iran. The sanctions just have not been effective. You know, the mullahs have their money now moved over to the United Arab Emirates and to Dubai. They've got freedom of travel. The people who are suffering are the average person in Iran, not the leaders or the mullahs or the Ahmadinejads. They're not suffering at all. They're doing quite well. And the sanctions are, especially when you've got German companies and French companies continuing to work, and Russia and China actively involved with assisting Iran economically. China's got oil and natural gas deals. They're planning pipelines out of Iran into India and China. I mean, Russia is providing nuclear fuel. They're selling missile systems. They're involved with technical assistance to the Iranian people. I mean, Iran has got the economic wherewithal with those contacts to ride out any sanctions. And the sanctions are like Swiss cheese. They're full of holes. So we have not had the resolve since John Bolton left the United Nations. We have not had the resolve to push for tough sanctions. Well, what we should be doing, I've been saying this to the Bush administration since 2004, is instead of sending aircraft carriers, we've had as many as three of them off the coast of Iran and the Persian Gulf, one way or the other at a time, three at a time. What we should be doing is we should be sending fax machines and Xerox machines and computers and cell phones, satellite dishes into Iran, and let the Iranian people work out their own situation. I mean, you've got, you know, brave expatriate Iranians using their own money to broadcast every day back into Iran out of California. You've got Iranians around the world who are in touch with each other and working. And I'd fund a bunch of the different Iranian groups. Don't pick one faction. Don't say we're all going to be behind Pahlavi because he's the Shah's son. I mean, fund a bunch of them. And let whomever wins within Iran surface to the top as determined by the Iranian people. I'd have the president start giving speeches in which he would mention Iranian heroes who are in political prisoners, who are being deprived of their freedom, support the students. But we caused South Africa to drop apartheid without a war. We fostered the Ukrainian Orange Revolution without a war. Why do we think that our only choices with Iran are, you know, either capitulation or go to war? We've just not used a creative set of options in order to try to get the situation changed by the Iranian people from within.
Well, the Bush and Cheney tag team seem to be of a mindset that, you know, they've never seen a war they didn't like. And, you know, they have been very hawkish on all things being on the table. Now, all things being on the table with Iran is not such a bad idea at first blight, but again, I don't hear from the American administration ideas, fresh new ideas about Iranian citizens, like you've been saying for a long time, Jerry, Iranian citizens being encouraged to change from within, which has so many benefits in the area.
I mean, Jake, I walked 200 miles with the Iranians. We went from the Liberty Bell to Washington, D.C., right after I wrote Atomic Iran. You know, it took about a month to do it. And I've spent every day with these Iranian people. There were a group of us who were on the whole march. And I'll tell you, these are brave people who want freedom in their own country. Some of them were, you know, they're 70s, I think 80 years old, one of the men was. Determined patriots for Iranian freedom, highly capable, with networks back into Iran, talking to Iranians by cell phones while they're walking along, you know, from Philadelphia to D.C. Just give these people the wherewithal and the moral support and step aside. And that's what I've been saying since 2004. Let the Iranian people, but, you know, we from the White House think, well, we've got to solve the problem. No, we don't. Or that we have to engineer a military solution. No, we don't. You know, just engineer a human solution. Let the people of Iran go work it out themselves.
Well, I hope that everybody's listening very carefully, because it's another war in this area we do not need. And we don't have to have another war in this area if we're careful and we support the people of Iran.
And the consequences of it are incalculable right now. You know, you've got too many, you've got Russia allied with Iran, you've got China allied with Iran. Neither one of them are prepared to see the United States dominate Iran. They'd be prepared to see a change internally within Iran that was self-determined by the Iranian people. But, you know, I think from the perspective of the Middle East, it's not even clear that the current Iraqi government is fully self-determined. I mean, yes, the Iraqi people voted, and that was a brave moment. But, you know, since that vote was taken in Iraq, you've had nothing but, you know, politically engineering the parliament, the constitution, the compromises that have come out of this, and going right back to Shiites versus Sunnis, and now with the Shiites trying to grab control to right the deck after so many years in which the Sunnis were in control under Saddam Hussein. And Saddam Hussein was not Sunni, he was Ba'athist. You know, the only other Ba'athists in the area are Syria. And the Ba'ath Party goes back to the Mufti of Jerusalem, who was basically a protege of Hitler.
Well, Jerry, just to wrap up, I know you don't see yourself as a prophet, but do you see some of the elements that you've talked about here leading to another war? Do you think that's a very strong possibility?
I think the possibility is very high, and it could come from any number of ways. It could come with Israel just deciding they can't wait any longer for the possibility that Iran might have a nuclear weapon, because Israel is still a one-bomb state. One nuclear weapon detonated successfully over Tel Aviv could destroy the modern Jewish state as we know it. I've said that again consistently since 2004. Israel, when they see that day coming, will have no choice but, regardless of the consequences, to simply attack. That's why I called it at that point the Samson option, because even if you bring down the temple around you, it's your last option to destroy your enemies.
Right, exactly.
And so I see from that, or from the terrorist forces in Hezbollah, Hamas, any number of these situations, Pakistan destabilizing, more terror activity in Pakistan, Musharraf's inability to solidify a government, whether it's a military dictatorship or not. These are all forces which are very fluid right now in the Middle East. And the likelihood is that they'll move in a destructive direction before they get positive.
Mm-hmm. Well, this year is an election year in the United States, as everybody knows. And do you see someone there that would, if elected, sort of take some of the tack that you're talking about?
Well, I don't see, you know, you have Hillary Clinton will probably just do the same thing that Bill Clinton did, which is, you know, more of the same, all of the above in terms of talking, but not very effectively coming to any resolution of any problem. I don't think Hillary has any solutions for the Middle East. McCain might be a little bit more military inclined, but, you know, McCain is very hard to predict. McCain is really either a maverick Republican or an independent. I mean, it's very hard for me to think about McCain as a conservative Republican. I just don't see him that way. And both Hillary and McCain are globalists. So I think if they either one of them get in, you'll have much more continuation of this North American Union agenda. And I don't think either one of them is going to be a major friend of Israel, because they're going to side with the Islamic forces in trying to get a solution forced at Israel, just like Bill Clinton did. You know, Bill Clinton liked to present himself as a great friend of Israel. But the final analysis, he had Barak and Arafat trying to jam any kind of solution he could down the throats of Israel in the last days of his presidency so he could win a Nobel Prize. And I don't see that Hillary would be any more effective, and I don't think McCain would either, although McCain might be more militarily inclined. And, you know, in Israel, this Olmert government at any time could collapse, and if Netanyahu took over, Netanyahu would ramp up the military options as well. So the whole situation in 2008, I expect to remain very fluid, but then I think in 2008, the immediate thing will be dominated by here is trying to, you know, the Federal Reserve cutting rates. They can cut them back to zero if they want to. I don't think it's going to revive this economy. This is an asset problem. And, you know, if they want to reinvigorate the housing bubble by stimulating more housing prices to artificially go up and more, you know, fraudulent loans to be made, you'll just postpone the day when this has to come undone. And I don't see how you can ship our jobs overseas. Even if you cut our rates, it's not going to again create the jobs back in the United States.
No, actually, this year is there are so many hot points, from economy to political problems to the wars going on in the world. This is a very, very touchy year for all of us. And I do want to thank you for coming on the program, Jerry, once again with your very well-researched ideas, and also to tell my listeners that if they want to have a good look of what has led up to the situation where Iran is posing to have a nuclear weapon, I highly recommend Jerry's book, Atomic Iran, which you can get at Amazon.com, I would imagine.
Yes, and also on WorldNet Daily.
On WorldNet Daily, where you publish articles all the time.
All the time, I'm a staff reporter.
Well, and Jerry, let's just hope that the best things that can happen do happen.
Well, we'll stay positive, Jake. I'll continue to try to make suggestions, and we'll just follow it through and, you know, keep fighting the fight. I mean, I don't want to see us moving into a global economy where we lose the United States of America. And I don't want to see a situation developing in the Middle East where Israel is destroyed. And those are the two objectives I'm going to be continuing to fight for.
And thanks very much, Jerry, again, for coming on Authors Audio. I'd just like to remind people that you can go to our website, authorsaudio.com, and click on through Jerry's book title there, and you'll be able to get a copy from Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, and it's a very interesting book to give you a complete idea of what's going on over in Iran. And until next time, this is Jake D. Steele saying, keep on dreaming and happy reading. Bye for now.